This is Spencer King, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiologists' extended learning series featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You're about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, you will have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access to your mobile device. And each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/AXL. And now listen to a talk Glenn Hirsch had with Paul Richter, Director of the Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention and the Eugene Braunwald Professor of Medicine at the Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard. They discussed the Eugene Braunwald Lecture on Future Directions in Cardiovascular Medicine.
Welcome to AXL.
Glenn, it's always a pleasure to be here.
So today's interview is really kind of an interesting look back and a look forward. Dr. Richter is going to be focusing on the future directions of cardiology in the Eugene Braunwald Lecture on the future directions in cardiovascular medicine. So we were talking before the interview, and you said you were starting at 1930, and obviously it's 2019. So tell me what's so important about 1930 that you would start there.
Well, Glenn, first of all, it's a phenomenal honor for me to be having been selected to give the Braunwald Lecture here at the American College of Cardiology. Largely because Dr. Braunwald and I are extremely close. He's been my scientific father, my scientific mentor, and I am the Braunwald professor at Harvard. So he and I are both tickled to death to be able to do this. What I wanted to talk about was history of discovery and how things change in medicine and how, if we're lucky enough to add a few grains of sand to that change, it's a wonderful career. And I, starting in 1930, because that's when CRP itself was discovered, I'm going to 2030 because we have a ways to go yet, and we're not quite done with this translational process. At least that's the idea behind this talk.
And it sounded like you really got some elbow grease and dug down and did hands-on research, even looking up the original manuscripts and photographs.
One of the really fun things about putting together this lecture was making a decision that I wanted to give a history talk. So I went to the basement of the Harvard Med School Countway Library and started to look up manuscripts that I knew about because they're the core essence of my field. But these are manuscripts published in between 1930, 1940, 1950. Can't get them online. And I'll give you some simple examples. CRP itself was discovered at the Rockefeller Institute in 1930 by some very well-known individuals who began the whole field of innate immunity and immunology. A few years later, a guy who would go on to actually help discover DNA would be the first person to figure out how you could crystallize CRP itself. Heading into World War II in Europe, there was a physician in Sweden who would actually tie for the very first time these ideas of inflammation to our disease, acute myocardial infarction. And reading these manuscripts is quite remarkable because they didn't have the background in immunology and immunity that we have today. Remember, we didn't have the lipid hypothesis yet. And yet these people were thinking about what are the root causes of heart disease.
Well, so maybe you could walk us through some of the big steps in terms of CRP and history, but also the future direction. So what's the next big step? You started in 1930 in the crystallization of CRP. What's the next step?
Well, there was a very important man named Mark Pepys. He's Sir Mark Pepys in the UK. He's an expert in amyloidosis and complement, who would think a great deal about how is CRP itself produced and manufactured. And in a paper he wrote in 1980, there's a throw-off line about maybe there's something going on here with acute ischemia. Then in the early 80s, Brad Burke, among others, wrote papers about acute coronary ischemia, and Attilio Mazzeri, who at the time was the Pope's cardiologist, would write a very influential paper in the New England Journal about what inflammation might be doing in acute ischemia. But this all begged this question about, is it cause or is it effect? Is the ischemia a result of the inflammation, or is the inflammation just a result of ischemia? And that's actually where our research group would jump in, and the epidemiology community would jump in, with observations saying, no, the CRP precedes by decades the onset of your risk of heart attack or stroke. And that kind of begins this epidemiologic translation process that I've had the pleasure of participating in.
You've obviously been transformative in this field. And so you went from the epidemiologic side and publishing the original New England Journal paper on this in 1997, but you moved on to intervention side. And so maybe tell us the next steps.
Well, you know, Glenn, even before getting there, there's other people who need to be recognized who did things that we in cardiology don't always think about. I'll give you two examples. Epidemiologists who were thinking about Lou Culler, a longtime AHA ACC member, and Russ Tracy, who is known to many people here as a pathologist at the University of Vermont, who helped to actually figure out the assay for CRP. He and a guy named Nader Rafai would actually make this a mechanized assay that we could actually use. And Nader's gone on to now be the head of the AACR for his community. Charlie Hennekins, my scientific mentor, had run his physician's health study. And he and Julie Buring, who ran the women's health study, allowed me to go into these databases and start looking at, could we understand inflammation and future vascular risk? The statin story is also a story about people. It's about Mark Pfeffer and Frank Sachs, who had run their CARE trial, allowing us again. Yes, Paul, you can take this silly hypothesis and you can go ahead and investigate it in these very valuable databases that they had. That's been the story all the way along. Incredible cooperation from just phenomenally impressive people. We then got very lucky. We had cooperation from industry that was very important here. Without cooperation from AstraZeneca, we would have no Jupiter. Without the work from a group of people who work at Novartis, including a basic molecular scientist named Hermann Grom, who actually designed interleukin-1. And that was on the work of an academic, a guy named Charles Dinarello, who, interestingly enough, worked with Peter Libby very early in Peter's career, a collaboration between them that would ultimately lead to this, not just a discovery of interleukin-1, but to a molecule designed to block IL-1, and then having the opportunity to design a clinical trial to actually ask the question, if we inhibit inflammation without changing lipids, without changing blood pressure, would we not only have a mechanism and not only a biomarker to tell us your risk, but actually an intervention for our patients? And that's really the first three quarters of the story. But the problem, as I know you're aware, Glenn, is that after the publication of CANTOS, which is just about a year and a half ago, we hit a funny roadblock. It's a wonderful thing biologically, because one of the other issues that most listeners are well aware of is that the CANTOS trial didn't simply show that inhibiting inflammation did, in fact, provide us proof of principle that we could lower risk of heart attack and stroke. It also showed, fabulous for patients and biology, that we could dramatically reduce the risk of getting certain kinds of cancers, in particular lung cancer, another wonderful piece of biology. But that observation, ironically enough, has probably taken this drug away from cardiac patients, because the net investment now being made for interleukin-1 inhibition is actually in cancer. And so one of the reasons when I thought about how to write to give this talk, I want to make sure we went past today, is because our future, the next 12, 15 years to get us down that road, is how do we now find something inexpensive, easily applied, safe, that can capitulate what we found in CANTOS, but we can actually give to our patients. And that exploration is where we are today.
So why don't you bring us up to speed with what you're working on in terms of methotrexate, and also what are the next steps after that?
So the methotrexate study was an attempt to, in parallel, see whether or not a simple approach, alternative approach, would get us there. That study turned out not to work in terms of lowering vascular events, but quite remarkably, the way biology works has given us an incredible signal forward. So to summarize that very quickly, the NIH-funded methotrexate trial, CERT, showed us that if you give an anti-inflammatory drug that does not inhibit interleukin-1, interleukin-6, or CRP, well, you don't get any benefit. So now we know exactly where that pathway sits. Well, for people not familiar with this pathway about IL-1 production, there's a step upstream. This goes to something called the NLRP3 inflammasome, and there are inhibitors of that that are in development. You can go a step downstream to interleukin-6, and there's already available drugs that we use. Some of our colleagues in GI use to treat Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disease that are already available. That's another target for this process. Colchicine is an inexpensive way that might work, and there's some colchicine trials up and running already that should report out within maybe 2 years. And then there are some really remarkable things going on in this arena that even I had to learn about. One is work from a guy named Kevin Tracy talking about how you can actually electrically stimulate parts of the brain, and it alters your neural connections to your gut. And interestingly enough, interleukin-1 levels change. And this is being used now to actually treat some GI disorders. And you can sort of think about how that might work. But Glenn, I think the most remarkable thing is it's all back to mom and pop and apple pie issues. Today, the best thing we can do to lower our CRP, lower IL-6 and alter IL-1, it's the ACCHA Simple 7. It's diet, it's exercise, it's smoking cessation. And there's a revolution going on right now in terms of why are these interventions that we've known for 50 years the bedrock of cardiovascular disease prevention? And it turns out it's not just that they lower your lipids, and it's not just that they improve endothelial function, but actually diet, exercise, and smoking cessation are turning out to be very powerful anti-inflammatory interventions. So it's a very nice loop to someone who's fundamentally interested in cardiovascular prevention.
Well, you know, I appreciate you highlighting this whole journey and actually highlighting the people along the way, because it's really, that's what we're all here for, is treating people.
Well, so Glenn, of course, there's one more person we haven't talked about yet, and that's Dr. Braunwald himself. Gene has been, as I said earlier, not just my fundamental mentor. He's not just the man who hired me. He's not just the person who I still go to whenever I have fundamental issues. On my wall in my office in Boston is a signed manuscript that Gene is a author of. It's from 1956, and Gene sent it to me with a little note saying, you know, best wishes, Paul, signed by Gene Braunwald. And the wonderful thing about Dr. Braunwald, he's always thinking. And I think one of the things he was thinking there was, you know, Paul, I knew all this before you were born. And I think my adoration for him is just enormous.
I don't think you're alone in that. Thanks again for stopping by today.
It's a pleasure, Glenn.
This is Spencer King, Editor-in-Chief of Axel, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to Axel and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/Axel.